Bon après-midi. Je vous invite à prendre vos places. J'ai peut-être pas mentionné au début de la journée, mais on est en train de se filmer par CPAC. Alors, il faut sourire beaucoup, il paraît, hein? C'est ça. We're being filmed by CPAC. I didn't mention that this morning, but just in case you're wondering where all these cameras are going, one day in the very near future, you'll be able to watch yourself on TV in the middle of the night, I guess, when they show the video. I hope you had a good lunch. We're very pleased that you're back with us this afternoon. And I'd like to just remind you again to turn your cell phones off. S'il vous plaît, fermez vos téléphones cellulaires, vos iPods, vos BlackBerry, etc., etc. Je pense que même si la conversation ce matin a été très stimulante, très animée, the best is yet to come, as I say. And our two panels this afternoon are really going to drill down on lots of the issues that we came up against this morning and yesterday at this conference on public policy and crisis. We'll be now in the presence of this panel, which will look at how many cooks or whether there's too many or what kind of cook in the policymaking kitchen or room, and then that will be followed by an atelier or a panel on media, public opinion, and public policy. I just want to remind you we had a slight change in the sense that this particular panel will end at 3:15, so Denis is going to be quite strict about that, and we'll have a coffee break from 3:15, 3:30, and then start the last panel promptly at 3:30.
C'est avec un grand plaisir que j'invite Denis Saint-Martin, professeur au département de sciences politiques de l'Université de Montréal, à prendre parole en tant que modérateur de cette session qui demande son, qui devrait être, des acteurs de l'élaboration des politiques publiques. Denis.
Thank you, Antonia. Welcome to this session on how we cook the policy kitchen, a very intriguing analogy. I'm looking forward to the answer. Let me briefly introduce our three distinguished speakers. If you look at your conference program, you'll see that they all have a very impressive career, and they all bring a lot of rich experience to the world of public policy. My left, earlier this, human rights lawyer, with a very impressive career. Estepal, Chancellor, Professor of Public Policy and Administration at Carleton University, and Mrs. Mary May Simon, who is elected to the president of the Tapiri Katanami body. So I don't know if I pronounced it, but you can. So we're going to start with you, Pearl. Oh, no, with Leslie, exactly. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Denis, and thanks to Antonia and her colleagues for putting together this massive intellectual stimulus package that we're going to today with a whole pile of travel-ready participants and panelists. I've decided to essentially address the first question in those questions identified for this panel, and that's where does innovative policy, what policy or innovative policy ideas come from? Let me begin by saying that innovation is not necessarily a good thing. In the last few years, financial institutions were very innovative in lending instruments and designs of derivatives and all the other things that we heard about earlier today, and that hasn't turned out so well. One could argue that financial deregulation during the Clinton era was also innovative, and that also didn't turn out too well and actually was the platform of the foundation for the developments in the private sector. But that being said, I think we've just made the assumption that innovation, at least for the moment, is a good thing, a good development in policy, and we can return to the question, I suppose, when we're discussing in the discussion. So if we assume that it's good, the second question is, what constitutes innovation? So I had to think about that before I addressed the issues and tried to think about how to tackle this. In my view, innovation is not incremental. It's not minimalist. It's not small. Innovation should have either the effect of recalibrating existing policy systems, new regulatory oversight, financial institutions, deregulation of transportation or communication systems, or create completely new types of systems. So if we take that as our starting point, innovative ideas, as I define them, are not incrementally innovative. They're systemically innovative. They're big, not little ideas. And that's what I think we want to be addressing. Where do these big ideas for policy change come from? I'm going to focus primarily on the federal level, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized, of course, innovation can come from almost anywhere in a political or policy system. It can come from individuals, it can come from think tanks, it can come from civil society, from international organizations, NGOs, etc. So that's so platitudinous it didn't seem worth focusing on. It's really policy or issue dependent as to where the innovation, the innovative driver might come from. So that's a general but relatively uninteresting kind of conclusion. So I thought what I would do is basically take two types of focuses. The first is a fairly tight focus on the Canadian practice of innovation. For Canadian governments and Canadian policymaking systems, where do innovations come from in the Canadian system and for Canadian governments. And the second is a wider focus in terms of what I consider to be a new development in the generation of innovative policy ideas. Well, first on the tight focus, in respect, I'm actually borrowing an idea that Neil Bradford first put forward in a book he published in 1998 called Commissioning Ideas, where he said that Canada, in comparison at least to Europe, rises uniquely on commissions and task forces for the generation of new innovative policy ideas. And now we're talking lunch. That issue or that phenomenon of commissions, task forces, royal commissions hasn't been discussed very much in a surprising sort of way, because it turned out that they have actually been remarkably important in policy development. There have been over 200 royal commissions. I'm not talking about commissions of inquiry after the fact, but royal commissions since Confederation. And royal commissions are explicitly enjoined to address some issue of national significance. And then I sort of took a look at the list of royal commissions or equivalent types of missions that we've had since 1945. It's quite remarkable when you think about it, the kind of impact and the scope that these commissions have had in terms of generating new innovative policy ideas. I'm just going to read you the full list, but I'll just give you a flavor. The Royal Commission on Dominion Provincial Relations in 1937-40, pre-war. The Massey-Levesque Commission on the National Development of the Arts, Letters and Sciences in 1949-51. The Royal Commission on Canada's Economic Prospects, the Gordon Commission in 1955-58. A Royal Commission on Broadcasting, on Energy, on Government Organizations, something dear to my heart. Health Services, of course, the Hall Report, which laid the foundation for Medicare, bilingualism and biculturalism, stat of women, and it just goes on and on. And as we come to a more contemporary time, we're looking at the McDonald Commission, of course, which was hugely important in terms of generating the big innovative idea of free trade, which was then taken up by the Conservative government. So historically, a commission of this type has been really important in generating innovative policy ideas. But they're outside, if you will, government. They're not generating, they're not ideas being generated internally to government. They're outside. But my feeling is, and I have really no strong comparative evidence for this, but my feeling is that the current government has continued that trend of relying disproportionately on external advice as opposed to advice generated internally. And again, some examples. Now, they're not royal commissions, but panels or expert groups of one sort or another. There's the Advisory Committee on the Public Service, which was referred to previously. There's an expert panel on integrated business and human resource planning, a next panel on securities regulation, an advisory panel on the system of international taxation, a blue ribbon panel to advise on grant and contribution programs, an independent panel, of course, a Manley panel on Canada's future role in Afghanistan. So that's a pretty substantial list of external bodies providing innovative ideas and advice to government, to this current government. So we have a tradition and a history of relying on this type of external organized advice, and it appears at least the current government has continued that tradition. The question is, if I'm right, why? Why are they relying on external advice as opposed to generating it internally? Well, I think of four hypotheses. I can't prove any of these, but I'll throw out four basic ideas. First, there is a history of doing this. So in a sense, there's a tradition to follow. But that tradition itself is based on relatively weak political parties. That was referred to previously by one of the speakers. Because we have weak political parties and they can't generate strong policy or innovative policy ideas internally, they have a tendency to look outside or externally. Again, particularly for these big system-changing, game-changing types of policy initiatives. A second argument is that, or hypothesis is that the public service, federal public service in particular, has lost policy capacity ever since the program review exercise. It hasn't been able to reclaim that. I think that is true to an extent, and of course, been supplemented now by the argument that the Accountability Act has essentially paralyzed the federal government, so the public service are spending more time over their shoulders and filling out forms than they actually do real policy advice or policy work. I think that can be overblown. I think if you were a small business person trying to get a contract with the federal government, the Accountability Act would make your life hell. I think the cerebral functions within government have not really been that affected. But nonetheless, there may very well have been a reduction in capacity, consequently, I need to look outside. A third is probably a lack of trust by current government with respect to the public service. I won't say anything more about that, but it might be a possibility. And the fourth possibility is that many of these expert panels or outside bodies are bringing in business people. And this is a government that wants to be business friendly, and it may see a certain kind of expertise in the business community or among business persons that is not available inside government. And that's a way of bringing that set of voices into the policy process in an organized way and channeling it directly into government. So the tight focus is we've had this history, I think it continues, and there's some interesting reasons about why that's the case. The wider lens, I think a relatively new source of innovative policy ideas is networks. Of course, networks have always existed in the sense of interconnected communication among individuals or entities that share some kind of common interest or concern. But I think what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is the emergence of networks as actual matrices of idea generation. So they're not single actors, just think tanks or NGOs or international governmental organizations or governments or bureaucracies. It's actual networks of players and actors, often gathering in certain venues or sites, and it's the network of and the interconnections among these players that generate the innovative ideas. And our capacity to do that through communications and travel and all the rest of it that I won't go into, our capacity for that increased exponentially in the last number of years. I'll just give you a quick set of examples. I was in Washington a few weeks ago for something called Extractive Industries Week that the World Bank was holding. And it brought together, as I was told, everybody who's anybody in extractive industries. And the World Bank has a major concern about extractive industry, countries that are reliant on extractive industries. It was quite remarkable because I'm not an extractive industries kind of guy. I was there for other reasons. So I paid more than normal attention to who was there, how they interacted. And it was a global network of NGOs, of every type of policy actor, that were brought together in one site in Washington to exchange policy ideas. And they came up with innovative ideas that wouldn't have been generated in the absence of that gathering, of that group coming together. Another example is the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. 30 member countries, but it interacts with another 100 countries that are not members. So a global organization that touches on virtually every conceivable issue of public policy. But it has no coercive power, it has no leverage, it's not a bank. What it does is it's a broker for information. 14,000 public servants from the member countries and some non-member countries go to Paris each year. There are 2,500 officials beavering away in the OECD in Paris doing research. And that research and that interconnection and interconnectivity is something that is larger than the simple members of the OECD. It's a network of players and actors that generates information that becomes a kind of gold standard for what governments do around the world. The third and final example of this kind of network capacity that's different is the social networking technologies that become available, where individuals can flag blogs, websites in ways that completely outstrip a simple search engine like Google. And it creates a capacity for individuals to participate in networks and generate types of knowledge and information that simply wouldn't be possible in the absence of that nexus of interaction. So in my view, networks are a new phase, a new development in generating policy, innovative policy ideas. So the good news, and I'll finish on this, the good news is that I believe that we actually have lots of capacity, externally, even internally, to generate policy ideas, innovative policy ideas. I think networks are increasing and growing and are generating a huge supply of ideas. The real problem is the capacity to absorb and channel and manage those ideas to implement them actively. Thank you.
J'aimerais remercier l'Institut ainsi que Antonia, son équipe, ses collègues pour m'avoir invité aujourd'hui. Quand Antonia m'a demandé à peu près de vous parler aujourd'hui en tant qu'avocat et avocate en matière de droit à la personne, je me suis demandé pourquoi. Je l'ai demandé pourquoi.
The reason I'm here, although you'll tell me after we're done, is that I've kind of worn a lot of hats in the policy kitchen. I've been a public servant, I've been a federal public servant in the line department and in a central agency. I've had the opportunity to work in a provincial public service. I've been in the private sector as a lawyer in my own practice, and I've also been in a big firm. I've run shows. And like many of you, I'm sure I'm not exceptional, I've had many roles in the policy kitchen. So the notion of a policy kitchen might be cliched, but it's a rich and nuanced image, and one that I would like to explore a little bit more, and I wanted to make sure my session was after lunch for reasons that will become clear in a moment. I'm going to ask wonderful Stuart if he could get that going. So what you're about to see, if the technology works, is a video from 24 Heures chez Pierre Gagnaire. Pierre Gagnaire is not only a great chef and businessman, he's also a great innovator. His restaurant, which is a 3-star Michelin restaurant, is in the Rue Balzac in Paris. What you see in these images is complex and a texture. There are many people with different roles and specializations. There's real-time evaluation, checking of what's being done, by whom and how well. Different people work in every part of the business as part of the enterprise. It's both inclusive and, because of the nature of this particular business, exclusive. You see incense, the color, the spare elegance, the emphasis on quality, service, and professionalism at every stage. There is a sense of urgency, and yet the external face is precision and calm. Simplicity somehow emerges out of complex web, people, ideas, and things. The video conveys a strong emphasis on people communicating. The passion for the work brings a sense of intensity and focus. While the process is necessarily client-oriented, there is also a delineation and a separation of expertise, with each part of the process having its own integrity, purpose, and objective. There are many actors, and while not all of them are the head chef, they are each critical to the overall process. Watching an enterprise like this function is really humbling. I spent a little bit of time around that chin once, and I said to my husband, who is in a large law firm in Montreal, you know, before taking on an articling student, they should have to spend time in the kitchen here. Because understanding how one can actually make a contribution in an entity that's as complex as this, and I think public policy is actually an excellent analogy, not metaphor, for this kind of thing, make it clear that there's no lack of imaginative and innovative determined people in each of these areas, and many people trying to make a difference. There's no lack of people wanting to participate. There's no lack of bloggers and Twitterers and people out there on the internet to make a difference. Technology has increased exponentially your capacity to feed into the policy process. But a few of these willing actors can achieve a direct effect on policymaking, and certainly none is capable of doing it on our own. And I want to pick up something Leslie said that I think was important, is we may have many policy actors, but we actually have very few what I call paths to policy in the country. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One of them has to do with the roots of innovation, which is the first question, where innovation comes from and how it's developed. As well, while it's true that there are many actors jockeying social position, there are actually very few effective, I call them, paths to policy. And that's especially true for societal actors who come from disadvantaged groups, don't have voices in the traditional process. At the same time, there are examples of multiple actors at many levels and different social strata who are capable of making a difference. I'm going to talk about a specific example of that as I go through. And if you find that all these examples get really boring, then just keep watching the video and pay no attention. But the metaphor of too many cooks as something to avoid, I think, is maybe where the metaphor falls on a little bit, because there are places where having a multiplicity, a network of people engaged in the policy process is not only positive, but maybe, I think, for policymaking, sine qua non of good policymaking. Now, one of the reasons why chefs like Pierre Gagnère, open bracket, I have received no promotional money, emolument, or honorarium of any kind from Pierre Gagnère to do this. There are many restaurants who would serve as a background. But the point is that because of their innovation and ability, they're able to take ordinary things and make them extraordinary. And some of what you saw there was taking ordinary, everyday things and making them extraordinary. And that, to me, is what good policy and innovative policy is about. What I want to emphasize as noteworthy about this restaurant's accomplishments and good policymaking accomplishments is that these innovations take place in a venerable tradition. That happens, in the case of this metaphor, to be the French cooking tradition, but in the policy context, innovation, like in many other, is necessarily nested in the conventions and the rigors of specific procedures and methods. It's time-tested and it's anchored in knowing what works, and that means understanding evaluation, understanding policy, and understanding research. Context, practice, and experience, in my view, are the bedrock of innovation, however paradoxical it may seem to have to nest your innovation in tradition. There is a fantasy out there that innovative and sustainable public policy can come out of the blue, that brilliant ideas are born shorn of context, research, and heart, and spring out of nowhere to become paradigm shifters. This is not my fantasy, by the way. I know of one project in Canada, supported by hundreds of thousands of dollars, that has tried to figure out in the abstract how one is to sustain social innovation. Such projects, however well-intentioned and generously financed, cannot succeed, except perhaps in the minds of the well-intended donors, and usually the people who receive the funds. And the reason they can't succeed is because they're divorced from context, they're divorced from experience, and they're separated from the research. They will, however, succeed if they're connected to something. You only get traction and good policy ideas, in my view, from context, from determination, and from experience. If you're looking for a quick hit, ideas that are generically or genetically scalable, something that's immediately popular, this is not the recipe for a successful policy. There is no DNA for successful and sustainable innovation. It has to be grounded in what you're actually doing, what your context is. There is nothing, I don't think, that we can abstract from successful policy outside of the context in which it's developed. Short-term reactive policy, on the other hand, and we've had some examples of that earlier, is usually bad policy. But it's good policy. It's because it was a policy idea that was in the bottom drawer that found an opportunity because of the public attention to it, having resurfaced. A good example of the latter, of course, is the imposition of helmets for skiers and snowboarders in the wake of Natasha Richardson's tragic death. The Canadian Standards Association, of course, took the opportunity to develop mandatory standards around this kind of thing. Really meaningful innovation that's grounded in tradition, experience, and research can be contrasted with the fuss and froth that takes the form in public sector of restructuring. Michael Moran, a British public political scientist, called this hyper-innovation. And this following quote from a former British Auditor General, I think, is apposite to the kind of notion that legislation itself is good, innovation in itself is good, departmental restructuring in the federal public service is inherently good. And I quote, there's too much change in government. The administrative machinery is in constant turmoil. New departments are created. Old ones are dissolved. The amalgamations take place. This confuses people who have to work in them. It confuses people who have to work with them. Policy actors in general and government in particular need to move away from the politics and the policies of conviction, to borrow a phrase, and take a long view. This means paying less attention to short-term policy equivalents or epigrams or, in the worst cases, epitaphs of particular policy disasters. Innovative policy has to be founded on and productive of research and evaluation. Conversely, research and evaluation should be the provider of policy. I want to stop a second to tell a story. About 8 years ago, I was sitting at a dinner with Michael Pitfield, who asked me what I was doing, because he really is the kind of person who was very interested in what everyone else was doing. And I told him I was working at the time, an organization called the Policy Research Initiative, which at that time was located as part of, although it's not the right word, the Privy Council Office, which of course is a central agency. And I started explaining to him what the Policy Research Initiative does. And he cut me off and said, "Don't you know what I did?" Clearly I didn't. And I said, "No, what?" And he said, "Well, when I was clerk," he said, "we needed to have medium and long-term policy capacity that went beyond knowing how many fish are coming down at a given time at a particular river at 4:30 on a Tuesday. We needed to have the ability to have policy development that looked at the medium term, which is code for until the next election, and long term, which has been dropped in the PRI, and be able to examine and develop policy in the kind of proactive, preventative way that we heard in the sessions before lunch." Now, I think it's regrettable that the PRI has moved out of its central agency location. It's been moved into Human Resources Social Development Canada, where it's just become a research arm and its purposes attached to that department. And the reason I think it's regrettable is because the very lack of policy capacity that the federal government is quite rightly concerned about, PRI was in part developed to address. And having moved it into one department, it's lost, I think, a lot of its traction. The point being, as I said earlier, that innovative policy has to be founded on research and evaluation. The other way around is also true. You need to be able to say not only, yes, we can, but also, yes, it works. And I think that's one of the foundations for good policy in any context. Big, important ideas are not the stuff of hyper-innovation or a fascination with witty, short epigrams. Instead, I think they're born of iterative, parallel processes of research and the practical experience of being able to generate research and understand what's happening. They're generated by incrementalism that may not be sexy or shape-shifting in themselves or seen in the moment, but they're nonetheless major contributors to the innovation. I want to stop for a second and compare what I just said to what Len was talking about. I think it obviously is historically true that Royal Commission and looking to outside organizations for assistance in policy ideas is a fact of the Canadian Political Science Experiment. That said, all of these commissions and bodies have taken place in the context of public servants who've developed terms of reference, a broad social understanding of the fact that these particular royal commissions are necessary, receptivity to these things after the fact, and in some cases non-receptivity, as was the case in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People. So, yes, it's true that a lot of the expertise does happen externally. The fact of the matter is that external expertise occurs in the context of a much broader public service that has a day job and needs the opportunity to have other network, if you will, feed into the development of the policy process. Virtually all major scientific advances, I think, happen in this incremental way. Even if in hindsight we talk about innovation and breakthroughs after the fact, sometimes you don't know at the time something's happened. In fact, it is going to be a breakthrough, despite the media's penchant to pronounce breakthroughs in this way. I think most social science innovations happen in this way well. I want to be careful here about not minimizing the importance of thinking out of the box, intuition, brainstorming, ways to stimulate thinking. But if you don't know the contours of the box, if you don't know whether you're inside or the outside of the box at all, how do you step outside the box in order to think outside it? Another question that we were asked to look at was the drivers of public policy and other societal actors can influence the policy process. I want to give you one quick example of how I think the very networked process that he's talking about is growing strength and has generated important policy developments. And I want to use a Quebec example, given where we are. Thank you. Issue is the war on poverty, the so-called war on poverty. In 2002, Quebec introduced Bill 112, an act to combat poverty and social exclusion. This was not a bright, innovative idea. It was the result of years of social activism. It's the 1995 Bread and Roses March of the Quebec Federation of Women. Fast forward to 2008, those of you who read, I think it was La Presse, or Le Devoir, La Presse, Pierre Fortin wrote a very important article that appeared on the 20th of December 2008 talking about what's happened in Quebec 6 years after the war against poverty with its combined efforts of daycare, increasing social assistance, improving the daily wage or the minimum living wage. And the result is there are 40% fewer people who are poor, that is living below the line, in Quebec, and that's a significant improvement compared to A, Quebec, B, also the rest of Canada. He attributes this in this research directly to the activity of a large number of actors working in a progressive movement, unions, NGOs, government, think tanks, and so on, that have made a tremendous difference in the well-being of Quebecers on an everyday basis. Obviously, a lot of work to be done, but this is a wonderful example of how networks, policy, research, and experience have worked together and created a breakthrough. Thank you for your attention.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me here. Just to clarify which organization I represent, it's the Inuit Tapirit Kanatami, which is the national voice for the Inuit of Canada, and I'm the head of that organization. I'm really delighted to be here at McGill again. I spent some time years ago with Greta Chambers and other board members, and I really enjoyed it. So I want to begin by thanking Antonia for the invitation to the Institute to attend this conference and to take part, I think, in this very interesting panel. I want to take note that I guess this is your 14th annual policy conference of this kind, and I commend both the Institute and McGill University for sponsoring this very valuable and ongoing contribution to public policy making in Canada. In linking with the theme of this conference and the analogy being used today, I would like to start by saying that as an individual, I do see myself as a unique recipe of sorts. Although I do not usually describe myself as a cookbook item, I am a recipe of human experience and knowledge, cultural ancestry and language, significant historical background, important geographical origin, and evolving social, political, environmental, and economic circumstances. And I'm really talking about the Arctic when I say this, or as an Aboriginal person in Canada. And I top this recipe off with a deep sense that I, as a human actor, am absolutely privileged and thankful for witnessing and participating in key moments of this country's journey towards a life of political, social, and economic improvements and better cross-cultural understanding. During the period between my childhood, growing up in the Arctic among my fellow Inuit, to today, where, for example, I've had the unique opportunity to represent Inuit during the Parliament of Canada's apology for its residential school era, I have gained a broad perspective, and it's certainly a humbling experience. I do have appreciation for being able to connect the proverbial dots over this significant period of time in our people's recent history, which only took place within the last century. And like that moment in Parliament, the experience can also feel like it took place all within a heartbeat. Perhaps there is an element, some element of healing that is taking place. At times, I find myself unraveling the poignancy of this experience and of that historic day in House of Commons and before a nation of citizens watching it happen on their TV screens. It really blows me away to think about it. And as a societal actor and as an Inuk and as a national leader and policy advocate, this type of experience fuels my spirit, my vision, my belief and assurance that I have all the ingredients along with my people to continue to contribute to this nation's policy-making kitchen and the nation-building that in many ways for us is just starting, but with more to come. I am really excited about this, but yet I'm grounded. This speaks to my belief that Canada's Inuit and other Aboriginal peoples must be guaranteed a significant place in this country's policy-making process. It is a principled view that is steeped in our cultural and traditional belief systems and which is connected to our prior and long-standing use and occupation of our traditional homelands. For Inuit across Arctic Canada, we refer to this particular homeland as Inuit Nunat, that is inclusive of the territories which Inuit occupy in the Inuvialuit region, in the Nunavut Reed territory, in the Nunavik region, which is where I come from Kujuak in Northern Quebec, where we call it Nunavik, and the Nunatsiavut region, Labrador. We are an intrinsic part of the land that is Canada, and no one else who is not indigenous to this land can make the same claim. We are an indelible feature of this country, and it is up to the policy and nation-building process of Canada to ensure that we are a positive and foundational part of this country's decision-making institutions. Although we have been told that Canada was created in 1867 by the fathers of Confederation, Indigenous experiences are not shared in this history, and Indigenous perspectives do not share in this history. This has been most unfortunate. In fact, Inuit presence in the political and policy life of this country has only really come gradually into view over the past 40 to 50 years, despite the fact that Inuit have been inhabitants of the Arctic regions for thousands of years. It wasn't until the era of modern land claims agreements and the inclusion of Inuit under Section 35 of Canada's repatriated constitution in 1982 that our people finally came to public and political light. From an original call to unifying our political voices as Inuit in Canada at the beginning of the 1970s, Inuit have been successful in finalizing nation-building and policy-significant land claims agreements throughout the past 35 years, with the final land claims agreement being wrapped up in Labrador in 2005. Land claims, however, are not the final chapter in our story to become part of Canada's, to become part of the Canada as a people and contributors to its development. While we still face the important task of implementing agreements with signatories such as the Federal Crown, there are more issues that need addressing that current land claims are unable to address on their own. I truly believe that it is a matter of Canada's public policy processes and institutions to understand and help tackle the growing crisis and gaps that undermine our abilities to achieve greater things and to improve our overall well-being. Our most troubling gaps by national comparison between Inuit and other Canadians are starkly illustrated in physical and mental health care, housing, child care, youth suicide, unemployment, and educational indicators. These gaps are so real as to be surreal in a developed country such as Canada. The growing crisis in suicides and chronic diseases alone are enough to stop a community's development in its tracks. Additional stressors of unemployment, economic hardships, overcrowding, alcohol and drug abuse, violence, and incarcerations mount every year. I believe that among other levers, public policy in Canada must think and act creatively and innovatively in dealing with such extraordinary conditions that exist in our communities. A big part of my challenge is communicating these conditions to the policy community, conditions that are more than likely out of sight and out of mind from the centers and mainstream of policy thinking and policy making in Canada. As Inuit, this is our unique challenge. Unique challenges demand unique approaches, new frames of thinking, a branching out of the mainstream policy processes to the periphery where there are fellow human beings, fellow Canadians who require attention and should not be marginalized because they appear to be on the margins. Over the years, Inuit have been policy-related conferences, meetings, and forums. We've met with federal ministers, prime ministers, and presented for parliamentary standing committees directly, have engaged in policy development processes that involve federal, provincial, and territorial jurisdictions. We've written many position papers, from specific issues to broad approaches. We are certainly cognizant of some of the pressures and realities that exist within the political framework of this country that in many instances prevent our policy concerns and recommendations from fully going forward and making a difference for both Canada and Inuit. If the past 3 or 4 years is any indication, I would put forth the opinion that no matter how well your recipe for a new policy has been designed and backed up with statistics, arguments, needs, priorities, and budgets, our national political climate has become so fickle and unpredictable that it's difficult to tell from the kitchen as to what recipe will be ordered on the menu from those decision makers sitting out there at the tables who may be bickering and wondering if they should spend any money. It is difficult to predict how the economic recession will affect the policy process in general. Will it become more difficult or impossible to engage meaningfully? Will certain cliques or policy communities become more favored than others in the struggle for national attention and fiscal provision? While we certainly see some degrees of desperation going on, Inuit are a very patient people. Like the hunter who stands above a seal hole on the ice for many hours on end in extreme sub-zero temperatures with harpoon in hand and hopes for providing for the family, I have inherited this sense of patience and understanding. However, as a national leader and a policy advocate who works outside government and represents the original inhabitants of this country's Arctic, I will not stand for very long when our people are seeking a way in and a way forward in the public policy world. I will continue to act with practical solutions and achievements in mind that are most relevant to what we need in our communities. I have just one more moment. From the perspective of our lives in the Arctic, the fast-paced world of today can make some very fast food, disposable policy, and unhealthy choices. The quicker this world pushes, decides, and changes, the more unhealthy the recipe is for Inuit. We have to keep pace, but our pace is specific to the North, and there are many sensitivities in the North that have to be kept in mind, such as our culture, our language, and the state of our natural environment and natural food sources. As an Inuit leader of today and a policy advocate looks to tomorrow, I do thank you for the time you've given me to deliver my message.
And now we invite you for comments, questions.
Hi, my name is Melanie Vanstone. I'm a policymaker in the federal government. And as you may know it, as someone who works in policy, it's condoned and encouraged for people to spend a few years in one place and move to another position and move around and get different experiences with the sense that what's most important is your analytical skills or communication skills, and such a matter can be learned. So you can move somewhere and move somewhere else and just pick it up. But given what you're saying today about networks and given what you've been saying the importance of innovative policy being grounded in the knowledge of what's before, do you think that approach that takes place with the policy careers in the federal government is actually detrimental to the federal government's capacity to be engaged in innovative policy making?
I think it depends what you want your career path to be in the federal government. I think if you want to become a deputy, then you need to be able to bounce around every couple of years and do the job well in terms of managing what's beneath you or laterally, depending on what the nature of your mandate is. But I think that if you want to become an expert in managing complex issues, Cherise was talked about earlier, it's a good example. Criminal law, criminology are another example. You can't learn that stuff in 2 years, and you can't be any good at it in a couple of years. If the federal public service, in my view, is going to get good at using its policy capacity, then it needs to develop meaningful expertise. And one of the great things, and I'm a fan of public service, and I've always loved the time that I've spent there, but one of the most gratifying thing I find is to walk into a federal department and to have somebody who really knows what they're doing, because they've been there for a number of years, they understand the research environment, they know what the background is, and you can rely on what they have to say. They didn't just read a briefing note that was half a page long, and God forbid you get over 10 minutes in your briefing because there's nothing else to say. So I think it really depends on what you want your career path to be, and I think the trick is to get the balance right between these two skill sets. A lot depends on your own objectives, I think, as a policymaker.
If I can speak to that, well, I think it depends on the policy area that you're working in. Some are more complicated than others, and I think Pearl's point is particularly well taken in instances where you're working with heavily science, for example, influenced
policy fields or long histories or very, very complicated land claim negotiation, for example, or other areas of the policy where it is possible to ramp up reasonably quickly because they're less complex, they have less historical depth, they're not influenced by arcane science or areas of expertise that are excluded for most of us. So I think it really depends. In the more complex area, it's important to have longevity and sustained power so you can actually learn the field. On the other hand, there's some benefit to moving around and learning about the different angles that are embedded within some of the less complicated policy fields. I think it's more detrimental when policy managers or people that are essentially engaged in managing the development and rollout of policies or initiatives, whether reorganizations or anything else, when they move around, that's also part of the culture. There can be a tendency, of course, to start things which might end up being disastrous, but you've already jumped ship at that point, so there's no consequence attached to having this stuff up in the first place. So I think that's an area where more on the management side than in terms of policy research, it's quite important to have a certain degree of stability and not a kind of constant musical chairs.
My answer isn't really directly the same, but I see a lot of young people in Ottawa working for the government, and I think it's really important for these people, young individuals that are working in the public service, to think outside of the box. I think when you look at situations that we have, like in the Arctic, and the crisis situation that we have in different areas, we tend to be like a silo approach. We try and talk to the public service or even at the deputy level, and often they hear us because it's not within the policy framework that they're working from. So I think I keep talking to young people about how they need to think outside of the way things have been done in the past and to start thinking about new approaches as they relate to, at least to us as Northern and Arctic peoples, because in the past, the policies that were created, it wasn't intentional, I'm sure, the policies that were created in Ottawa that were directed to the Arctic didn't fit the situation, so a lot of those policies didn't work. So I think there's that part of the public service needing to pay more attention to new ways of doing, and also to experience it, and to experience the actual situation itself. So consultation becomes an important aspect of policy making.
Hi, my name is Tim Simmons. I'm from the Canada Millennium Scholarship Foundation. And we do research into higher education. And two comments that were said today on the panel kind of arrested me a little bit. One of them was the comment about past to policy or participation in policymaking, and the other one was about brokering knowledge in sort of environments such as these. And I think we're benefited today because we're in a room of people who appreciate inquiry and who have an appetite for evidence-based decision-making. And I guess my question is how we reconcile that with the absence of such an appetite in the general public, particularly the private sector in Canada. Think about the U.S. and some of the private investments in higher education research institutes that my colleagues and I interact with. There's a proliferation of groups that are funded privately that create paths to engagement for unrepresented marginalized groups and then communicate that and sort of create a movement so that government has to pay attention. In Canada, I think we're sort of, if the government isn't at the head of that space creation, we don't get there. So I almost feel like we're in a situation where there aren't too many cooks in the kitchen because there's one actor that keeps the fresh fruits and vegetables stored away. So how do we do that here? Because I think what Leslie and Pearl were getting at was, in order to have innovative and creative ideas, there has to be intentional deep thinking, and that doesn't always happen automatically or in the space of time that's governed by behavioral economics and political psychology.
I think one of the most important comments that I've heard so far today was, I think it was Philippe Courrier, when he said that you have to have values before you go and make policy. In Canada, the value framework, of course, our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and that's one of the most important contexts within which we develop our public policy. Within that framework context, obviously there is a huge number of people who want to get into the room, and Mayor talked about some specific contexts where, for example, Aboriginal peoples want to get in the room and develop policy, but where what there is really limited series of paths to that policy or ways to have access to the decision maker. And one of the differences between Canada and the United States seems to me is, first of all, the relatively small number of media diversity that we have in this country make the communication of those messages extremely liberal and extremely restrictive. Sorry, sometimes people think they're very liberal, and it's hard to get into the room, and it's particularly hard for marginalized people and people coming from racialized or otherwise marginalized communities to have an influence in the policy process. The other big difference, or one other difference, which we haven't talked much about, is the role of grant makers in affecting public policy in Canada versus the United States. Max Bell Foundation, which partially funded this conference, is one of the few in Canada to recognize the relationship between charitable organizations, effective social change, and public policy. There's almost no grant maker in Canada that has made that connection, maybe with the exception of Maitri, but very, very few of them have done that kind of work. In the United States, on the other hand, you have massive charitable organizations. I'm not only talking Gates and Warren Buffett's money and so on. There's a number of charitable organizations and grant institutions that have significant influences on public policy that in turn draw from not only some mainstream groups, but also much more marginalized groups who might not otherwise have a voice. So I think your point's absolutely well taken. I think one of the ways of dealing with it is to encourage better paths to policy to make sure that these voices can actually through. I think networks is one of the strategies.
Yeah, follow up on that. Part of the cultural difference, I think, between our business class and the American business class, we don't have the Carnegies or the Rockefellers and others building positions and donating enormous sums of money for a whole variety of causes. On the other hand, I gather that there may be some aspects of tax law that will be a disincentive for the establishment of those private sector foundations that will channel money into doing policy research. But it's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, policy research is not as sexy and doesn't attract as much attention or concern as childhood diseases or poverty or social conditions that will draw more resources that way. So on the one hand, that's a kind of pessimistic aspect of it. But on the other hand, the more optimistic view that I take is that there really is a huge amount of research out there, not just Canadian research. And we are weak in some respects because of the kind of media outlets and specialized journals that we have. Our think tanks are great, but they're relatively thin, again, in comparison to south of the border. But we can connect internationally. I mean, all kinds of research being done, and we have the capacity to plug into that, again, through networks or simply by drawing on the information that's available. So that's sort of the ledger I think we're actually better off than we have in previous years, which is much more difficult to get access to this kind of information. So I take that as an optimistic aspect of plugging into the policy process and giving people more opportunity. Finally, I mean, we saw the phenomenon of the Obama election and his capacity, his massive capacity to mobilize citizens, not just to donate small amounts of money to his campaign, but actually get engaged in the campaign. We're also not necessarily so pessimistic about how disinterested or disengaged citizens needfully be. They might in fact be mobilized or engaged if there were more of a political will to draw people into the process. And we all know many, many government departments and agencies now on a routine basis are engaged in some kind of consultative process. It doesn't mean that the consultations actually lead to changes in policy, but most policy developments now will have some aspect or some component that involves a consultation, and that again provides opportunities, not always the best opportunities for some excluded groups, but at least there is a platform there, and that's quite a culture change in the way that we make policy today from the way that we made it 25 years ago.
If I could just respond very quickly. I don't know if you're aware, I don't know your name, but we did a project with the Millennium Foundation. And I think it was a very important partnership that we had because when I first got elected to ITK, one of the things I wanted to address was education, because without a good educated population, we're not going to be able to take on the jobs and have our own governance structures. We need to have all that in place and have a well-educated population. But we're not graduating our students. Except a few, and some of them come to McGill and they go elsewhere. But generally speaking, our graduation levels are at 25% out of high school. So we partnered with the Millennium Foundation. I think this is it's been a really important process because it's taken us 2 years we had a conference in Inuvik, a national conference. Took us 2 years to negotiate a national education accord that is going to establish a national steering committee for Inuit education, and we're signing the agreement next week with the federal government. So it's taken a long time, but these complex issues. But the objective is to look at the education system across the Arctic and see what has worked, what hasn't worked, what needs to be changed, but not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and start from scratch. That's not the objective. Some things do work. I mean, we do have an education system. But the objective is to try and set up an education system that will have a standard that will allow students come to Montreal and get into McGill if they so wish. Right now they don't because the standards are very different. Whether it's good or bad, I don't know. I'm not an educator, so I can't make that judgment. But there's a mismatch. So these are some of the things that I think when you talk about brokering knowledge, that these are things you can really work at from another angle and eventually bring the parties together.
Chris Reagan from McGill and Dartmouth. My question relates in terms of metaphor of the kitchen, not so much to how many cooks are involved, but perhaps the types of cooks and perhaps even the types of meals being prepared. At the Department of Defense, I've now been there for just under 3 months. My sense is that it is a very reactive place. It is a building chock full of very smart people doing lots of very policy work, but it is reactive policy. And perhaps the Department of Finance is more like that than departments, I'm not sure. But my sense is from people that I speak to is the department as a whole, the government as a whole is quite reactive. My question is, I mean, in some sense this must be the nature of the beast. There's lots of things going on outside of Ottawa, outside of the world, and politicians and deputies must react. My question is, how could one construct a world where politicians and their deputies are a little bit less reactive and a little bit more thinking about long-term policy?
Well, I can take that first. Excuse me. My example of the kitchen, one of the reasons that an advisory panel and expert groups, I mean, that's one of the reasons exactly why, another reason why they're set up is to get out of the day-to-day transactions and to be able to take a longer view of issues. I don't know whether this government is any more reactive than other governments have been. It seems to have a solid agenda. No other wants to go. It has to be reactive because of the financial crisis right now. But I think that's just going to tend to be a reality. From what I know about how things operate on the inside, it's just a daily reality of having to deal with issues, fires, and things that come out of a field that you can't anticipate. And my sense from people I talk to is that they're run ragged. I mean, they're in constant motion dealing with, and you're right, absolutely, smart sort of people, but it's not that they're distracted. I mean, it's part of their job. But they're constantly engaged in the day-to-day. And, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, if I just for once be able to think, a little bit more medium-term as opposed to having to deal with something that needs to be done and, a briefing note written tomorrow or this afternoon. So I think inevitably we're going to have to rely on some kind of hybrid or, external sets of advisory bodies or think tanks as part of their role to look long, make contributions in that way. Advisory panels that are struck can do the same thing. Academic institutions, and we have an increasing number, as we mentioned the other day, of schools of public policy, policy programs, policy institutes, and I think that's great. There's 100 flowers blooming, and they're making increasing contributions to again that long-term point of view. So I think if you look at the whole picture and not just concentrate on what's going on in government, you can see a policy system that conceivably can develop the capacity for long-term views and more innovative ideas as opposed to the day-to-day. And governments, better or worse, most of the time I think are going to be dealing with the daily challenges that occur to them and then draw from their sources for the longer-term ideas. The tricky thing is to try to, as I use the term hybrid, are there other ways that we can think about designing the connection between those institutions, designing networks of some sort or other that would draw on the advantages that are internal to government with the advantages of those kinds of bodies, entities that are outside of government. And we haven't, we have conferences and, we've developed some networks, but I don't think we've really thought very creatively about other ways in which we might combine these different players in new formats.
Just a couple of thoughts to pick up on that. One of them is that I think that federal government, well, a couple of things. One of them is that horizontal policy projects, I think, are a good idea. There's something that they haven't talked a lot about at the federal level, but the federal governments do them that well. I talked a little bit about the Policy Research Initiative earlier. A lot of attempts have been made to deal with horizontal policy, data gaps issues with moderate success, and that's because I think the central agencies have invested sufficiently in them. There's also a hierarchy of federal departments in terms of who they're prepared to interact with and take seriously or not, and finance is obviously at the top, and eyes roll when certain other departments walk in the room to horizontal policy meetings. I think there does need to be a better, in terms of the kinds of cooks, I do think that there need to be a better sense that many different perspectives are sometimes needed on different kinds of projects, and organizations' internal policy capacity, not only in the medium term, but also the long term, is something that's always been lacking in the federal government, not for lack of effort, but I do think it needs to be resuscitated. One strategy, funding think tanks is another one. This particular government has not been great at even-handedly funding think tanks across Canada, across a number of different perspectives. I think we could be better at that for the reasons Leslie talked about. And the third strategy, I think, that is an existing mechanism, but it's sorely underused, is the equivalent of the interchange program, which would be something like you went in on, but, you know, something really well in Europe, which has moved people in and out of senior levels of the public service, part of the way that people do business. It happens relatively rarely here. We are more likely to jet off to Oxford and Cambridge and try to get the best, the cream, whatever it is, people to call such people. The fact of the matter is that there's a lot of really bright people here in Canada, in the private sector, in a number of other areas, that we can bring to the public sector for 2, 3, 4 years in their area of expertise, really rely on having them go back into the private sector and have a much better exchange. That program already exists in the federal level, but it's really underused, and I think it could be much stronger than it is now.
I don't have a lot to say here, but I guess I would just add we are looking for a reaction, actually. We never get much attention, so we're always looking for some kind of a reactive sense that they're paying attention, because I think the Arctic, you know, with the sovereignty issue and the melting of the ice cap and the Northwest Passage becoming ice free and the potential for oil and gas development has really sort of brought the federal government to pay some attention to the Arctic. So we're trying to piggyback on this attention that we're suddenly getting because of climate change. It's not the people they're paying attention to, because the problems that I was describing before are real. They're very real in our communities. So it's not really about people. And I have a cross-Canada tour that's called Sovereignty Begins at Home, because we're telling the federal government to, in order to assert the type of sovereignty that we want as a country, and we support the assertion in every way, and we're not saying... we're not saying no militarization, we want it to be limited, but we're saying that in order to assert our sovereignty, the best way to do is to build sustainable communities and to make vibrant, healthy communities in the Arctic where people have lived for thousands of years. And it's the presence of those people that assert Canada's sovereignty. So, you know, we're trying to, you know, convince our political leaders to look at it from a human perspective. And it's really an uphill battle. So I don't know the answer to your question, because we don't get attention very much.
Angela Kanidis, I work in the federal government. I've worked in all of the areas of justice. I'm at PC right now. I do want to say, Les, that your comment about us reaching out, that's what I love about all the independent research institutes. We do reach out. And we're also inviting PRI to give us a presentation on some of the research they're doing at PCO, so we bring that in. But my question is actually for Mary Simon. In terms of pathways, do you feel that it's different to having an MP from Nunavut, Minister Eglepiquet, as a minister in cabinet? Is that making any difference to the kind of access you feel Northern Conservatives have into government?
Yes, I think it will. I mean, it's, you know, she just recently got into the cabinet, so she's still fairly new in the job. But certainly, people are you know, very hopeful that this is going to help us get our message to cabinet, that we have offered to help with Leona, work with Leona or Minister Aglukart to tell a story to cabinet about what kind of health issues we are facing. Because I think we need to convince the powers that be that this is a real life issue, because you don't really hear it every day, you don't see it every day, you see it in the paper once or twice a year, you know. So for those people that make those decisions, it's not real. So I think it will help, but we're still a bit too early in the process.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, Pearl, is that a trick video, the fact that nobody ate any of that food?
Sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Was it a trick video, the fact that nobody ate the food?
I
have two questions for Professor Powell. The first one is, my students would never forgive me if I didn't ask you, what are the e-ministries, the ones that you can work at and you can get to speed like that? You care to name a couple of them for records? You're not answering that one?
Before Leslie Anders, I just want to say that I have been at the restaurant and have eaten the food, so I can attest personally to it. So.
Nobody ate. You were in the thing? It was,
yeah.
I didn't know that there was some subtlety there that I was not getting.
If there is one, you'll let us know.
I got it. You move it back. So the e-ministries?
You said two questions, so you have another question?
I do.
Yeah.
And the other one's that, I'm really seeking your intelligence about this. You talked about rural commissions and had a long and impressive list of them, and then you said this government is reaching out also and talked about a number of independent advisory panels, including, for example, the Manley Commission on Afghanistan or committee, whatever it's called. I would have thought that there was not only a difference in degree, but a difference in kind between those two sets of external bodies. The Royal Commissions offer, you know, a vast body of research, and whereas these other groups do bring a different perspective, but it's not really research, and it's a group of people who have a different perspective, maybe business expertise. I would not consider them, you know, at all comparable. And so I was really interested in your kind of putting them in the same continuum. And it seems to me I would like to be informed. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll deal with the second question. This is a little easy. I do think that they are comparable in the sense that it indicates seeking expert advice as opposed to just consultation, as opposed to consultations with citizens. It's going outside, assembling a group of advisors that do some research. They have some staff and do some investigations, bring to bear their expert views consult with different government agencies and departments to provide that kind of advice. But you're right. I mean, Rolf Schenick, the one on Every People's, or Donald Kishon, is qualitatively different in terms of the mountain of research that produced their more extensive arm's length relationship to government. All I was trying to point to was that it struck me as interesting that we have this long tradition of going outside into a certain type of body, and it struck me that, again, some evidence that these types of external advisory groups are being drawn on by the current government. But they're not exactly apples and oranges. I do think that there are some interesting similarities in terms of going outside the public service for that kind of support. And now the easier question. I think it would be inappropriate to try to a particular department or even a policy field, they all have their own, you know, internal complexities. What I'm trying to point to is one that, for example, science-based, has a strong scientific component. I mean, it requires the same scientific background to be able to come to address those things, health issues, for instance, or extraordinarily complicated legal questions like land claims negotiations or some of the human issues that we're dealing with. I would say generically, aspects of government activity that are operational, that are less embedded in a certain areas of expertise, both scientific or legal, are easier, not easier to do, but they're easier to get a handle on because there's a whole background or backlog of additional expertise that one needs in order to make sense of it. That's all.
We're going to take two last short questions. So Antonia here and Edie there.
Using my prerogative, but I can't resist. Yesterday, when Mr. Flaherty was talking about his the way that, as an administrator, he reacted to the economic crisis in Canada, he talked a lot about talking with actors outside of Canada. He mentioned Ms. Paulson more than he mentioned any of his other cabinet colleagues, or even, indeed, Mr. Harper. So I'm wondering if you could give a sense of how important global networks are, or global actors in the kind of policy work you've done or that you've studied.
That's for me specifically? Well, it just so happens that my current research is on global policy networks, and for those of you in the academic world doing policy, this area of investigation research has exploded exponentially in the last 10 years, not coincidentally, since the visibility of global policy networks, particularly international governmental organizations like the World Bank, like the OECD, I already mentioned the UNDP, international foundations like the Soros Foundation, MacArthur Foundation, global networks of NGOs. All these they haven't suddenly appeared, but they, because various elements of these networks have existed before, but their synergies are what's new and different. And so the overall impact, I think, or influence of international actors intergovernmental agencies or intergovernmental agencies particularly has become much, much more important. In this particular case, I think it was in one of the earlier panels, and Mr. Lynch, I think, mentioned it as well, policy processes increasingly require international coordination, from climate change to the international financial crisis. I'm old enough to remember a time when you could do domestic public policy, be a Canadian public policy person, and that was about the extent of it, and then there were other people who did the international side. That's simply not possible any longer. In order to get a handle on any serious domestic Canadian public policy issue, you have to take a look at what's happening internationally, because our policymakers here are interacting, connecting with their counterparts and interlocutors internationally. So that's been a very significant change, I think, and it's not likely, I think, to be reversed, at least not in the near future.
If global actors are very important for us in Nordic. We have an international organization that works with Inuit around the world, because we have Inuit in four countries. And when it comes to climate change issues and how that is impacting on us, we're sort of tied, our hands are tied in terms of what we can do, except that we didn't talk to the government about adaptation, because unless they cut the emissions and change the way they do development, I think that it's going to keep changing. So that is a big issue for us, a big issue. Another global actor important to us is UN level with human rights. The human rights agenda for indigenous people is massive, and we continue to work very heavily at the UN on this issue. So global partners, actors are very important for us.
I just want to pick up the issue of UN and international or global actors. There's an out issue, but there's also an outside-in issue, which is that historically Canada, in the international sphere, of course, likes to see itself, and it is very active. There's a committee we sign, there's a committee we go, there's a meeting we're off. But internally, within Canada, we're not very good, and we have not been very good historically, about internalizing and incorporating the international obligations that we've signed on to. Canada signed the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 1976. We still haven't transformed a lot of those obligations into domestic law. Our position on Indigenous peoples has not been, stellar. The way in which Canada interacts with the international community historically has been very much inside out. I think we need to get better about looking at the norms that are developed, that we have a role in developing internationally, and thinking about what the implications are at home. And just by way of a very brief example, I've had conversations with people in PCO when we were looking at particular policy issues and talked about the particular obligations contained in covenants that Canada had signed years before, and in at least two cases, the deputies or the AEMs, who were not, by the way, from Justice, the end might have been different, said, well, those things are for developing countries. They're not... They're for Burkina Faso or something. They're not really. So having an understanding of what our role is internationally and really being able to think about what the implications are domestically when we sign on to these national agreements, I think is extremely important and an integral part of the question Antony asked, which I think is critical.
One last very brief question. We're going over time.
Actually, I was going to use a question to see if we could shift the metaphor slightly. Some of the ah moments today, it seems to me, are to do with the need for more pathways in policy. Chris Reagan's confession about reactive politics and desire for proactive. This panel's notion of need to reach out. Sharon Messinger's sense that the new generation has interesting pathways in through the web. Peter Russell's notion of the Teach Institute. And Mary's very astute sense there was a disconnect between the way we were preparing our young children and higher education, and there's a sense of that schema or transition between elementary, high school, and perhaps post-secondary. In a country like Canada, where we have a federal government, but we have education largely regulated and administered at provincial and sometimes, frankly, local level, how can we do a better job about that schema and preparing our students? How can we think more about the prep kitchen than the kitchen?
I think that's a very good way of putting it. It's the preparatory work that's always crucial in any policymaking. And, as a national leader, I don't really do anything except talking to the people up north, because I need to know what they're thinking, what they want, because what I decide and do doesn't necessarily meet their needs. So I think, thinking ahead and formulating you're going to take into the kitchen is very, very critical. I agree.
Well, it's hard to disagree with that. Of course, I guess There's another connect that we haven't talked about much, though I think it was partly raised in Sharon's interest and Peter's, that on one hand, younger people are extraordinary, are living in a very information-rich world and are using technologies, and I don't want to romanticize too much, but it strikes me using technologies, multitasking, multi-channeling, they'll be on Facebook while they've got email going on and downloading iTunes and, you know, blogging. No, I don't do that. Email's not as far goes. So on the one hand, you've got what appears to be, you know, a really distinct capacity to manage a lot of information simultaneously. On the other hand, most of that is your communication, it's social networking, and it's entertainment. So if you could somehow leverage or utilize the availability of these technologies, which are being used and used, you know, just without even second thought, even by very, very young people, if we could leverage that, then I think that might be a pathway to doing the prevention, to getting people beginning to think about larger policy issues or being more engaged in the public life of their communities. I think we have, in a sense, the capacities there, and there is a certain appetite for drawing on information. It's just not the kind of information that necessarily engages people, particularly young people, in public issues.
My daughter is 11 years old, and she knows the topographical, geographic divisions of every single part of Quebec, but she doesn't know Saskatchewan and Canada. And she's not so sure about Ontario, but she knows she was born there, so somehow that links in with being Canadian. And that comment, you know, has, I think, links back to the panel that was right before lunch, which was, you know, teaching our kids civics. Rudyard Griffith has a terrific book out now on some of these issues and has done a piece in Month's Maisonneuve magazine on it. Making sure that we have the capacity, that we're teaching our kids this that we're talking about today. I was thinking about the question earlier from a person from finance, it was the question before that, which was, you know, how do you get people engaged in public policy? I think you go to the average person and you say, are you really excited about public policy? They're going to act like you're reacting. And you know what I'm talking about. So it's when you start to talk about the issues and the context of the particular things that people care about that they start to care. Health, poverty, children's issues, Aboriginal issues, how people are doing. Those are pathways into getting people engaged, and it's part of the way you get kids engaged as well.
Well, the policy kitchen is now closed. We're going to take a 10-minute break, Antonia. Je vous invite à remercier avec moi nos trois conférenciers.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Thank you, all three panelists. That was a wonderful panel. Thank you, especially Mrs. Simon, for coming this long way from Quebec to be with us this afternoon. It was a real honor. And I'd like to now invite you to a very short coffee break. We can reconvene for 3:30. Thank you.